And we're joined on the telephone right now with Lori Schmidt, and she is the Wolf Curator at the International Wolf Center in Ely. Lori's also a teacher and instructor at Vermilion Community College in Natural Resources Department on forestry and wildlife topics. Lori, welcome to the Roadhouse. Nice to have you here.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Just this week now, we had there was an incident in the news that occurred down at the Minnesota Zoo where a Mexican gray wolf slipped out of his cage, kind of was able to worm past the fence and jumped over the fence and into the area where visitors are at. The wolf was shot. That's created kind of a little mini firestorm throughout the state as far as the procedure on what should happen in those events. And as a curator at the International Wolf Center, you've studied these animals up close. What are some of your initial thoughts when you read that article about what occurred?
Well, the first thing I've learned, I started with wolves in 1986, so I've seen a fair share of behaviors, is that I know that wolves are capable of amazing things when it comes to finding the smallest opening to be able to get through. I also understand that in later reports they were talking about a couple of new animals that had come on site that it appeared that this wolf was kind of posturing towards, and we know that wolves can be very territorial, and so certainly motivation may have been very strong for this animal to, you know, deal with those what may be perceived as trespassers in his mind and his territory. So I certainly understand the wolf behavior, and I also understand that, you know, the secondary barrier fence, when he did clear that secondary barrier fence, which is kind of the secure area for holding any wildlife species, being next to the public is obviously public safety is everyone's job, you know, from the standpoint of animal management. You know, we work with the animals on a daily basis, but the reality is when there's a lot of people, that situation can change dramatically on the circumstances.
Mm-hmm. I believe the options, as far as I see it, would be either to shoot the animal, try to capture it, or dart it so it can be captured easily, more easily. Have you had to dart animals in the past? Do you understand the procedure that happens then?
Yes, we're all trained in darting, and we have a dart rifle here. But I've not had to dart any of the animals that I've worked with in the last since 86. I have had a situation where animals have been out of their enclosure, but I work on a little bit different scenario here. The animals are socialized to humans. They're raised at a relatively early age, around 12 days of age, bottle fed to reduce a little bit of that flight distance between the handlers and the animals, so the animals readily approach. We do a lot of hand injection and things. Not saying that if they were to escape, that they would still come to us, but it makes it for a little bit easier management to deal with an animal like that. This was a non-socialized wolf. That means a wolf that was, had a very strong fear avoidance behavior of humans. And I know that there are people, you know, successfully have darted wolves that have been loose. Peg Callahan at the Wildlife Science Center had a similar circumstance last year where someone had cut the fence, and I believe three Mexican gray wolves had gotten out of the enclosure. She was able to get two back relatively soon, but one of the gray wolves was loose somewhere down around Forest Lake for 3 days, and she was able to dart it. Again, the situation may be a little bit different from the zoos for that scenario, in that it was not in such confined area with high volume of people. But again, I don't know the circumstance of that. But I know darting, you know, it's not an instant thing. I think some people, you know, watch too much of the Discovery Channel, and no offense, but they, you know, they maybe clipped out the 15 minutes where the drug, you know, took effect. I mean, as soon as you're hit with a dart, you don't just drop to the ground, you know. It takes a while. That's a muscle, an IM injection, an intramuscular injection. It takes a while for that to process through the bloodstream to make the animal a little bit woozy and then to actually fall down. other thing that if that animal had been running for a little bit, it's probably pumping quite a bit of adrenaline and maybe a little bit high stress, and it may burn up drug pretty fast. So it may not be a simple, you know, like a dose of an animal who's just in a pen may go down fairly easy, but the animal who's agitated and been running, you know, may not go down as easy. So there's a lot of variables there, and I think, you know, you always have to go back to the fact that there were kids around, there were people around. Chances are there was a lot of noise going on. It may not have been one of those decisions where they had the time to do the darting. I mean, I can't speak for them. I don't know their scenario, but I certainly can see their point, you know, that public safety in a high-volume area is certainly a priority.
I believe what I read in the article was that they mentioned 8 to 10 minutes before the animal would be, sedated.
Yeah.
In a darting.
Yeah, it varies. We just did an immobilization of 2 11-year-olds here, and we hand inject, you know, meaning I just put the syringe in their muscle meat of their hindquarters. And even for those two, I mean, they were relatively calm when I made the injections. It was definitely at least six minutes for to the point where they were down, and, you know, I felt that they weren't going to get up in flight, you know, as someone went towards them.
Yeah, it's as I read the article, it appeared to me that the procedure had already been, you know, they had gone through a plan. What happens if one of these animals does get out? And what they had mentioned was everything went according to plan. This is how we plan to handle it. And that seems to preclude any darting as part of their regular procedure.
The one thing I would question is, did their procedure, meaning that shooting was an option, if it left the security barrier area? You know, meaning that if, rather than a wolf just gets out of its enclosure, if it's still in the secondary security area, they may have had a protocol for tranquilizing in there. But by the fact that it went beyond the secondary, it's like you have a step process in your protocol. If this happens, we do this. Well, he went from A to D, you know, in a short period of time by leaving that secondary holding area, that secure area that was non-public, and probably amped up a few steps of the protocol. So
yeah,
I would.
When he jumped the fence, then everything changed. You're saying?
Yeah. I guess what I'm saying, I don't know what their protocol. I know I can only speak for our curator manual. You know, we have, you know, protocol. If they get out and they're in the secure area, well, you get some food, you open up a gate, you lock them into a kennel, you figure out where they went out, and it's not a big deal. They get out of the secure area. Well, as I said, that's open. Now that's a whole nother level of protocol, and what they may have been referencing, again, I don't know, can't speak for them, but they may have been referencing the protocol was if they got into the public area, that was the protocol to shoot. I would certainly, in fairness to them, ask them, is that your same protocol if a wolf just escapes into the safety zone? You know.
Yeah, they really didn't specify those things, and I'm sure that was a part of the whole planning strategy. I noticed that they also talked to a spokesman for the Como Park Zoo, and he said that they all follow similar procedures, and it could be other animals. I know he mentioned that they had a Corella escape in the mid-1990s and had to deal with that. So as we read that article, it's not a it certainly isn't cut and dried which direction should occur.
Sure. Well, I know from just, again, speaking from our experience, I mean, we have protocols for windstorms. We have protocols for fires, you know, fire evacuations, you know, because we are in a forested area in Ely. Our enclosure is fairly forested. We're not immune to wildland fire issues, you know. So just from speaking from our own circumstances, you know, every scenario is laid out with a little bit different tweak to the management. So there's not one blanket situation, you know. I mean, if a fire runs through and crowns and just passes right over us, that's different management than, you know, if the because we share our fence line, our wolf enclosure, part of it is the window of the building. Well, if the building burns, that's a whole different set of scenarios, you know, because a wall of the fence is gone, you know. So I just from speaking from our experience, I think there probably wasn't as much detail in the press release that specified the uniqueness of that situation being outside of the safety zone.
What is the difference between now? We have gray wolves here, of course, timber wolves, but this is a Mexican gray wolf. How do they differ from the wolves that we're used to seeing in the wild and at your wolf center?
Sure. Well, the whole wolf subspecies issue is being debated because of new genetic information, but at this time, biologists do recognize 5 subspecies of gray wolf in North America. You actually mentioned the timber wolf. That's a slang term for a wolf that used to be, prior to 1992, the term for this wolf, eastern timber wolf, that was here in Minnesota. In 92, the Society of Mammalogists reclassified what went from 24 subspecies down to 5, and actually now we're considered to be the Great Plains subspecies. So the eastern timber wolf is believed to be one of the 5 subspecies, but is believed to be in eastern Canada, maybe near Algonquin Provincial Park in Ontario, kind of that area, and no longer exists in the lower 48 states. So the term timber wolf, that used to be our subspecies name prior to 1992, now they're considering it Great Plains subspecies. So basically there's 5. There's the Arctic, there's the Mexican, there's the Great Plains, there's the Northwestern or Rocky Mountain, and then the eastern timber wolf, as I said, that's kind of up in eastern Canada right now. The difference in the Mexicans, Mexican wolves are typically a little bit smaller, although I've seen some of these captive-bred animals that are in really good body size. Usually a little bit misproportioned leg ratio, meaning their legs may be a little bit longer, if their ears might be a little bit taller. If you're thinking about adapting to an environment where there's a lot of heat, you're going to want a lot of vascular exposure in areas like your ears or your the surface of your legs where you can cool yourself. I mean, wolves don't have sweat glands like we do, so they cool themselves by having veins close to the surface or by panting to evaporate heat. So these Mexicans look a little bit taller than, let's say, an Arctic wolf who might have very cupped ears, very kind of roundish cupped ears, and maybe a little bit stockier and maybe a little bit shorter. Because if you're in the Arctic, you know, the last thing you want is surface pains and being exposed to 70 below weather. So those are all adaptations about the geographic areas that they live. And really what's going on scientifically right now is, as genetics improves, they're saying, biologists are saying, you know what, there's maybe not a lot of difference at the subspecies level about these wolves. Maybe they're clearly different just because of the adaptations that have maybe changed their coloration or their size, and that's more dictated about where they live and what food availability they have and how they hunt and what the ecosystem looks like around them that might make them different. Behaviorally, a wolf is a wolf is a wolf. I mean, from the standpoint, we here at the Wolf Center, we have Arctic subspecies, we have Great Plains subspecies, and we have Northwestern subspecies. And the reality is, there is innate wolf behavior that dictates how these animals function. And so we don't see a lot of difference in that.
But, the Mexican wolf, as I understand it, it was quite rare and has been quite a process to bring that animal back into the wild. It, for a while, I believe just about all of the U.S., the species that live in the U.S. were in captive situations, and they have been restored to areas around Arizona. Does that sound right?
Yep. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think there weren't any real reliable sightings of wild Mexican wolves reported since probably the early 80s, where they believed to have captured the last 5 individuals and were placed in a captive breeding program in Arizona, and those would have been captured probably in Mexico. Now I think they're well over 240 maybe in a captive breeding scenario. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is in the process of trying to reintroduce them into habitats, but there's a lot of work to be done. Certainly a lot of public education is probably needed in those release sites. The human-wildlife conflict, specifically with wolves, has a lot to do with agriculture and livestock, and certainly there's some potential for problems. I know some of the released animals that were not successful. Some were, but some were not successful and were taken back out of the wild and placed in captivity. So it's an ongoing process that the Fish and Wildlife Service is doing, and certainly if anyone would be interested, Fish and Wildlife Service does a great job in their educational component referencing how successful that program is going.
Mm-hmm. I know some folks, including myself, have never been to the International Wolf Center in Ely. Can you describe briefly what you do there and the scope of the center?
Sure. We've been here since 1989. Actually, we had a temporary exhibit in 1989, in 1990 and 91, and in 93 we opened a year-round exhibit. Our function and our mission really is fairly clear: to try to teach wolf education, to try to be unbiased, to try to present both sides whenever possible. It's our goal is through education to at least advance the survival of wolf populations by teaching about wolves, where they live, their relationship to wildlands, and most importantly, how humans affect their future. You know, again, our issues are not it's not an advocacy facility. It's trying to explain in some cases both sides, trying to take scientific information and present it to the public so that they can make informed and accurate wolf decisions. Accurate meaning, you know, we want to make sure people understand the wolf behavior. There's a lot of myth. There's a lot of concern about wolf behavior that's unwarranted from the animal. That's some related to literature, some related to childhood stories. But the reality is the fact of day-to-day life for wolves is they're a social pack animal. They're a predator at the top of the food chain, and they have always been a part of northern Minnesota. That's the other thing that, they weren't put here. I mean, they have been here all through the persecution throughout the Great Lakes area, where wolves have been eliminated from Wisconsin, from Michigan, from lower parts of Minnesota. They've always been up here in the Arrowhead region. So this is not a reintroduction or a trial like you might see in Yellowstone. They're essentially part of this ecosystem and always have been. So that's our role. And basically, to meet that mission, we do educational programs, we do classes, we have learning vacations for people, we have a magazine, we're a member-driven nonprofit organization, which means we're supported by our members. We have a retail store here. We basically have the wolf exhibit. We have actually two of the Northwestern species on display right now for the general public. We do puppies every 4 years, meaning we get pups from another professional captive facility, and we rear them up and socialize them and introduce them to the exhibit pack in 2012. Our next set of pups are due. So that's kind of we accomplish our mission of education in a variety of formats. Basically, we're open 7 days a week, 10 to 5 right now after June 15th, 10 to 7. So June 15th to August 15th, it's 7 days a week, 10 to 7. And then we go back to 10 to 5 from August 15th to October 14th. So pretty much it's a 7-day-a-week event for people to come. We have a museum, the Wolves and Humans exhibit, which was well-known in the early 80s, created by the Science Museum, and it actually toured the country, and it was kind of a record-breaking exhibit for the Science Museum, and that's how the Wolf Center was created, was to find a permanent home for this exhibit. And I believe Grand Marais was actually in the running for that. And
it was being considered,
mid-80s.
Yes. Is there a website, Lori, that you could give so people can take a peek themselves?
Sure. The website is fairly simple. It's www.wolf.org. WOLF.org. So it's simple, and there's a lot of good information. You know, the Learn feature kind of shows people a lot of educators some educational materials. One in particular that I'm very interested in providing is basic wolf information, and we have a kind of a Wolves and Humans series flyer. One of them is Living with Wolves, and I know. One of the other things that we do here at the Wolf Center is we run the Wolf Helpline, which is kind of a call-in place for people who have wolf sightings or wolf problems, and we try to help them through it. And I know the area of Grand Marais, Tofte, Lutzen has had some issues with pups that are kind of near a road that people call in. They see them, they feel sorry for them, and they feed them, and next thing you know, we've got a wolf who's habituated to humans. So we've got some good information on that about, a flyer Living with Wolves, a flyer Too Close for Comfort, another flyer Are Wolves Dangerous to Humans?
And all that can be found on the website, Lori?
Oh, yep, all on the website.
Great.
off the learn section that people can find it. And the only other thing that's new for those people who have been here before, and we do have a new exhibit called Our Shared Planet, which is a traveling exhibit.
Excuse me, Laurie, is that also on the website? I'm sorry, but we're running out of time.
Oh, running out of time. Sorry.
We have to...
No, Our Shared Planet is not on the website, but if you've been to Ely before, you know, a lot of people say, well, I've been there already, what's new? There's always something new going on here. So
great. Well, it sounds like there's a lot going on there.
Yep.
Laurie, I want to thank you so much for giving us your time tonight, and I got to get over there and see that myself.
Yeah, come on over. Let me know when you're coming. I'll give you a behind-the-scenes tour.
Thank you very much. That was Laurie Schmidt, and she is the Wolf Curator at the International Wolf Center. As we mentioned, you can see her website at www.wolf.org.